Good morning. Strikes between Iran and Israel complicate Trump's hopes to end the war. The Wall Street Journal explains the dilemma facing the president.
The conflict had been between the U.S. and Iran, and now all of a sudden Israel attacking Hezbollah, Hezbollah attacking Israel has become part of this whole dynamic.
Millions of people are about to descend into U.S. host cities for the World Cup. Politico looks at how public health agencies are getting ready. And The Hollywood Reporter on the UFC's road to the White House South Lawn. It's Tuesday, June 9th. I'm Cecilia Ley, in for Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. The attacks between Iran and Israel have stopped, at least for now. Sunday night was the first time the two countries had come into direct conflict in 2 months, igniting fears that they were spiraling into open warfare. But yesterday, both sides pulled back. It began when Israel struck at Hezbollah in Lebanon, accusing the Iranian proxy of sending rockets into northern Israel. Iran then leapt to Hezbollah's defense, and the two began attacking each other. As rockets entered the skies, President Trump urged Israel not to escalate, making direct phone calls to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Alex Ward, The Wall Street Journal's national security correspondent, brought us up to speed.
What matters here are a couple of things. Number one is that this was a threat to the U.S.-Iran ceasefire, right as both sides indicate they might be semi-close to a deal, although who knows if that is really true. There has also been this question about whether the Israel-Hezbollah and U.S.-Iran fights would be linked. The Iranians are linking them because of Hezbollah, and the U.S. and Israel say, no, they are separate issues. But now that there's been an actual linkage between these two conflicts.
And that could make a peace deal all that more complicated. Trump has mainly focused on Iran's nuclear ambitions for a deal and talks much less about degrading regional proxies, one of the original stated goals. But last night demonstrated how important Hezbollah could be to the fate of the fragile truce.
And if there's a violation of the ceasefire, then it makes it less likely that President Trump can get the agreement with Iran that he so desperately wants and is pushing for. So all of a sudden, this Israel-Hezbollah fight, which has been going on a really long time, but has been escalating in recent weeks, is now, after the last 24 or so hours, an even bigger component and part of the fabric of the U.S.-Iran deliberations over Iran's nuclear program.
Israel relies on the U.S. for its security, and Trump has claimed in the past that Netanyahu will do whatever he asks. But Israel struck at Hezbollah despite Trump repeatedly urging restraint. Israel argues that attacks from Hezbollah leave them with no choice.
And Netanyahu basically said, look, these attacks on Hezbollah and Iran have stopped for now. If Israel gets attacked again, then, you know, the fighting could restart. So President Trump's whole thing is he's trying to keep the region calm, and he's trying to do that in order so he can get this deal. But if the region continues to flare up, that just complicates that process.
Over the weekend, Trump had a tense exchange with NBC News' Meet the Press. Before walking out of the interview, he was pressed by Kristen Welker over his campaign promise to avoid any new wars.
So when you say I promised, I didn't promise anything. I don't like these endless wars. This is not an endless war. We've been doing this for 3 months. Much of it has been under the form, a pretty good form of ceasefire. The blockade has been amazing. Our Navy is amazing. Our military is the best in the world.
Even with the fighting on pause again, the Strait of Hormuz remains effectively closed, choking off the world's oil market. So far, the economic crisis has been acute in countries that import a lot of energy, and global reserves are draining. But it's been somewhat contained for the short term, thanks to adapting supply and demand dynamics. Namely, the U.S. has increased its energy exports, and China has reduced its imports. Publicly, at least, Trump says he feels no urgency to end the conflict in a hurry and cross his negotiating red lines.
That said, you know, if there are more flare-ups in the Middle East, if gas prices skyrocket, if there are more economic disturbances, if the Strait of Hormuz doesn't reopen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it's hard to imagine that Trump doesn't start to feel some sense of pressure to either wind down this war and sort of make a deal that he doesn't want to make, or perhaps escalate the conflict in short order, which in his mind might get Iran to heal.
On Sunday, the White House will become an unlikely fight venue. President Trump is hosting a mixed martial arts event on the South Lawn, a spectacle unlike anything an administration has ever attempted.
Everyone's asking me for tickets for the UFC. That is going to be great. They're going to have the greatest champions in the world all fighting that night.
Dubbed UFC Freedom 250, the event takes place on Trump's 80th birthday and is ostensibly part of the various celebrations tied to the U.S. semi-quincentennial. But the idea goes back a bit further.
So this UFC fight being held at the White House actually has its origins at Madison Square Garden, a couple of weeks after the 2024 election.
Alex Weprin is a senior editor at The Hollywood Reporter.
Dana White, he was sitting next to Trump, and Trump kind of made an offhand comment, "Hey, I think we should do a fight at the White House." And White was like, "Oh, yeah, okay, sure, yeah." He didn't know what that meant, but it turns out he was quite serious.
Trump and White go back decades. In the early 2000s, a lot of venues avoided UFC events, and MMA was banned in most states. But Trump was one of the few who welcomed the organization into his casinos. That helped legitimize the sport in its early days, and they've remained close friends ever since. Now that relationship has entered the political arena. White is a MAGA supporter and has enthusiastically tied the UFC brand to Trump's presidency. Trump, meanwhile, has tried to appeal to White's legions of young male spectators.
You know, it's interesting. After he won the 2024 election, one of the first people to speak at Mar-a-Lago was Dana White.
And we also have a man, Dana White, who has done some job. He's a tough guy.
And one of the things he did was call out some of the podcast hosts that hosted the president. I think he kind of gave them some credit for helping him win.
White helped facilitate Trump's appearance on Joe Rogan's show and pushed the influential podcaster to endorse him in 2024. Other podcasts with big male audiences followed, and Trump carried over half of young men at the election. Since then, though, his approval rating among those voters has dropped, and some of those podcasters have expressed ambivalence towards some of the administration's policies, like the war with Iran and tariffs. Weprin says Sunday's event could be a kind of olive branch to those folks and the people they influence.
I do think that it's something to look at and think about. I'm very curious to see who shows up to the event. Will they invite some of these hosts to the event and try and kind of win them back in person? Because I do think he made a lot of ground in that world for the 24 election. I think there's a good chance he wants to win them back ahead of the 2026 midterms to try and kind of get them to support the Senate and House candidates that he wants to support. So to the extent that he's lost any support there, I think he does want to make efforts to win them back. And this could be an event that helps that.
The event is now on the verge of becoming reality. A fight card is set, and an enormous stage is currently under construction at the White House, which will feature a full-size fight octagon and a 5,000-seat arena. But it might not be smooth sailing. Rogan himself has criticized the event's outdoor setting, raising concerns about how the weather and bugs would affect competitors. And in the background, the Public Integrity Project has filed a lawsuit claiming the administration was illegally hosting a sporting event on federal parkland. As cities across North America get ready to host the largest World Cup tournament in history, one question has been looming for public officials. Are they ready and prepared to keep the millions of incoming fans healthy?
We are, as a country, a lot better prepared for a major outbreak, a major global event than we were pre-COVID, but it's nowhere near the infusion of public health funding that we saw during the pandemic.
That's Rachel Bluth, a healthcare reporter for Politico. As fans from around the world descend on host cities, they will, of course, gather in packed bars and venues. That can create some risks, and Bluth has been looking into how a fractured U.S. public health system is bracing itself under pressure.
Things are getting more expensive. States everywhere are tightening their belts. There's just, I think, a little less support overall. And fundamentally, the federal administration has kind of communicated that public health is not sort of top priority for them when it comes to where the budget is and how it gets funded.
FEMA has set aside $625 million in grants for the World Cup, but state public health officials are only getting a small slice of that pie. Even so, Bluth says state and local agencies have surveillance systems to help detect and respond to a wide variety of threats.
The main one is called syndromic surveillance. And that's where local public health departments, clinics, hospitals are going to be monitoring people's symptoms and reporting that to the CDC. So that if you're a public health official somewhere and you're seeing a rise in respiratory symptoms or people showing up to the ER with rashes and fevers, you kind of know what you're looking for and you know what to be monitoring for.
The outbreak of Ebola in Africa remains a major concern for the World Health Organization, but Bluth said diseases found at home were a much bigger priority for officials here.
Everyone I talk to is far more worried about the spread of measles at these games than about Ebola. You know, we know measles is circulating in this country. It's much easier to catch. One person told me that measles particles can stay in the air in a room for like 2 hours afterwards. So whereas Ebola, you need really kind of close contact with somebody to contract it.
And when it comes to measles, one technology that gained traction during the pandemic will especially come in handy.
They're hooking up the city's existing wastewater surveillance system, which they use to track diseases all the time. They're setting that up to the sewage at SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles so they can collect samples and get them to the labs and see if there's just a spike in pathogens that you wouldn't expect to see. Is norovirus showing up in the sewage? Are measles pathogens showing up? So there's kind of all these ways to get ahead of a major outbreak before it gets really bad.
Federal pandemic resources have allowed LA to try out this pilot program of surveilling germs being flushed out of the stadium, which will host 8 matches. In the meantime, health officials say they're feeling as ready as they can be for the big stuff that might emerge throughout the tournament. And they told Bluth they want the public to worry more about the everyday risks.
They are worried about people washing their hands, driving drunk, using drugs, having heat exhaustion, not drinking enough water, getting exposed to the sun. These are the things that public health is worried about. So if you are planning to attend the World Cup and you're worried about Ebola or hantavirus or anything like that, your time's a little better spent making sure that you are hydrating and putting on sunscreen, because those are probably going to be your main threats.
The tournament kicks off this Thursday. And to a few other stories we're following. Voters across 4 states, Maine, Nevada, North Dakota, and South Carolina, will vote in primary elections today. And one race to watch is the gubernatorial election in South Carolina. This is the first time in 16 years the governor's seat has been open. But considering South Carolinians have not voted for a Democratic candidate since 1998, the real battle is among Republicans competing for their party's nomination. Trump recently endorsed Lieutenant Governor Pamela Evett, who has made loyalty to the president a centerpiece of her campaign. Representative Nancy Mace, meanwhile, has said that she believes her willingness to defy Trump on issues like the Epstein files is why she didn't get his support. Evett is leading in most major polls. It was a Hollywood ending for Neithia Raman last night, the latecomer to the Los Angeles mayoral primary race. She jumped ahead of Spencer Pratt, the Republican reality TV star who had grabbed headlines for his polling in a Democratic-leaning city. Raman threw her hat into the ring hours ahead of the deadline and ran on a progressive campaign that targeted Pratt's links to the MAGA movement. The LA Council member now goes up against her political ally, the incumbent mayor, Karen Bass. And finally, for decades, the Naval Observatory has served as the residence of the U.S. Vice President. Many of them have left their mark on the 72-acre property. A heritage garden from Joe Biden, beehives from the Pences, pink wallpaper in the library from Kamala Harris, and back in 1991, Dan Quayle added a swimming pool. Now, Vice President J.D. Vance has made his own addition, a chicken coop, complete with a dozen baby chicks and a Victorian-style hen house. It turns out Vance is right on trend. In recent years, backyard chickens have seen a resurgence. One recent survey suggests about 11 million U.S. households have them. The move may also have been a practical one. During the 2024 campaign, Vance often complained about the high cost of eggs and jokes his 2 young sons eat about a dozen eggs every morning. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the news app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Bloomberg Business Week reports on how freezes on foreign aid from the U.S. and cuts to other funding sources are making the current outbreak of Ebola especially hard to contain. If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And we'll be back with the news tomorrow.